Part 12 of The Roots of Buddhist Psychology, a teaching on equanimity with Jack Kornfield.
So this quality of equanimity, like joy, loving kindness, and the others, in certain ways is cultivated in spiritual life as a relationship to experience. But in another, if we pay attention, can be discovered as our innate state, as we awaken to our true nature. Remember the passage from Thomas Merton, "Then it was as if I suddenly saw the secret beauty of their hearts, the depths of their hearts where neither sin nor desire can reach, the core of their reality, the person that each one is in God's eyes." You know those moments? Just a moment when you see someone like that. If only they could see themselves as they really are. If only we could see each other that way all the time, there would be no more need for war or hatred or cruelty or greed. I suppose the big problem would be that we would fall down and worship one another. So this is that kind of seeing that is true. Equanimity means balance or peace. And in the Buddhist teachings, they talk about the cultivation or the discovery of generosity and compassion and patience, truthfulness and equanimity over thousands of experiences and thousands or hundred thousands of lifetimes. Whether you take that literally or poetically, it doesn't matter. But in the course of experience of what we love and what we hate and what's pleasurable and what's painful and what's praise and blame and light and dark and up and down, gradually we begin to realize that the world has both of those dimensions and that they're inseparable, that you can't have dark without light or sweet without sour or pleasure without pain. They are unified in this whole that makes up our life. And the teachings of upekkha, or equanimity, are a balance that we discover to see with the eyes of wisdom, with the eyes of a Buddha, the coming and going of our life, of all life, and to rest in the heart of compassion that is at one with or feels the sorrows of all living beings and yet rests in a sense of peace. Sometimes it's called divine equanimity, a sense of grace that comes, that rests as we honor and trust life in the midst of the slings and arrows, to use Shakespeare's phrase, and the beautiful things that come, that trusts deeply the seasons, the turning of the earth and the stars, the tides of the ocean. For if we look, the seasons change. The rainy season comes, the winter, and then spring and summer, and autumn and winter again. People, animals, seasons, the stock market, the phases of the moon, generations, grandparents, great-grandparents, children, grandchildren, buildings, cities, nations, civilizations, Sumeria, Babylon, Egypt, Greece, Rome, China, the great Indian civilizations, the Aztecs and the Mayans, the empires, remember, the Romans, the British, the Spanish, the Portuguese, Spain and Portugal divided the world, that's your half, not so long ago. The Russian Empire, that was just a few years ago. The turning of the stars. All arise and pass according to their nature, according to the cycles of life. When one discovers or rests in equanimity, it doesn't mean that we don't care about the world. It's more like a parent with their child, that we love them enormously, and hug them and care for them and weep for them. Yet in the end, every parent discovers that it's impossible to possess your child. And the more you try, the more difficulty and suffering there is. We love and nourish and set free our children to honor their own nature. And as they get older, they go out the door and all you can do is pray, right? I read some statistic, for example, that certainly in the teenage years for teenage boys driving, in a majority of cases, they will get into a car accident from when they get their license to when they turn 20. That's why the insurance rates are as high as they are. So it's kind of an initiation and a very scary one. So there they go. And what can you do? They go out the door with your prayer. And the fact is, in those moments, that we discover that the earth moves with some much greater plan than our own. And that we can't control another person. We can't even control ourselves. How many control their thoughts in this room? Raise your hand. How about your feelings? You can't even do that. Not to speak of the people you live with. I know you've tried that. Didn't work either, did it? You discover that no one can let go for another person. No one can grieve for another person. No one can love for another person. No one can be enlightened for another. That we each have our own cycles and seasons of growth. So we do what we can and rest in a center, discover a sense of ease and graciousness and timelessness, which is the discovery that the greatest gift that we can offer is our own peaceful heart. When things are difficult or there's struggle around us, the gift we bring is our own peace. The description of Thomas Merton's going to these huge, wonderful stone Buddhas carved in the cliffs in Sri Lanka, walking barefoot in the morning on the dewy grass under the trees, and coming upon these enormous statues that he said were the most beautiful pieces of art that he'd ever seen. Alive, extraordinary faces, great smiles, you know, the smile of a Buddha. Filled with every possibility, questioning nothing, rejecting nothing. The peace not of emotional resignation or withdrawal, but a peace that has seen through every question without refutation, without establishing some other argument. Just seeing the world as it is. To discover equanimity, this balance, is to discover a kind of radical acceptance of life and a not knowing. Because we don't know how things are supposed to go. Remember, things went bad sometime and it turned out differently? You all know those stories. Like the Chinese story of the man who is prosperous and fortunate because he has the horse, and then the horse runs away. Remember that? Mm-hmm. Oh, he tears his hair out. Terrible fortune. But then some weeks later, the horse comes back with a wild horse, and now he has two. Great fortune. But his son, on going out to train the new horse, tries to ride him and falls off and breaks his leg. Son may always limp. Terrible fortune, my boy. But then the army comes through town recruiting all the well, able-bodied young men for the war, you know, the war against the barbarians that we're still fighting this day, right? But the son can't go, oh, he's so fortunate. How do you know? Really, how do you know? A radical acceptance of the heart, an honoring and opening of life. Woody Allen says, most of the time I don't have much fun. The rest of the time I don't have any fun at all. There's a famous story of Milton Erickson, a psychiatrist and a brilliant hypnotherapist who was taken through a locked ward in a state hospital, and there was a man there he was introduced to who believed himself to be Jesus and nobody else. He was Jesus. And they tried everything they could to kind of work with him and talk him out of his delusion unsuccessfully. And Milton Erickson simply went up to him and looked at him and said, "I understand you're a carpenter. Please come along with me. I have some work for you." And immediately the man came along and started to work in the wood shop. They didn't even talk about who he thought he was. And that was the beginning of his cure. Like Suzuki Roshi, Zen master, dying of cancer. "If when I die, I suffer, that's all right, you know. That's just suffering, Buddha. No confusion in it. Maybe everyone will suffer because of the physical or the spiritual agony, but that's not a problem. Having a limited life like we do, if you had a limitless life, that would be a real problem for you. If when I die I suffer, that's all right, you know. That's just suffering, Buddha. Sun Buddha, Moon Buddha, Happy Buddha, Sad Buddha. This is the place, the place in us that knows that this is what life is. This mind, this heart," says the Buddha, "is luminous. It becomes entangled in fear and grasping and delusion. And therefore the unknowing person doesn't see the true nature of life, of the mind. Consciousness and all that comes into it is luminous, free from entanglements. Discover this for yourself." So in spiritual life, in spiritual practice, we tend to begin with outer forms of precepts: to not harm, to speak the truth, to not act in ways that create suffering. We steady the mind through the breath and attention and meditation. Use these forms to discover or awaken, to come back to ourselves. But in the end, they become natural to us. They are natural. What was virtue or kindness becomes what's called adisila, which means innate virtue. In the moment that we recognize that we're not separate, we naturally can't harm another. In the moment that we recognize that the world is as it is, we find a peace and a steadiness, an innate concentration. Our problems come when we get identified with some story. We grasp at the senses or this body or our plans, the body of fear. "About this mind," says Ajahn Chah, my teacher, kind of offers something different. "The truth is, if you look at your mind, it's nothing. It's just a strange phenomena. Within itself, it's already peaceful. That your mind isn't peaceful is because it follows its moods, its likes and dislikes. The true mind doesn't have anything to it. It's simply an expression of nature. It becomes peaceful or agitated because our moods, likes and dislikes, deceive it. Sense impressions come and trick it into happiness or suffering, sorrow or gladness. But the mind's true nature is none of these things. Gladness or sadness is not us, only the mood, the response. The unawakened mind gets lost, follows these things, forgets itself, and we then think it's we who are upset or sad or whatever. But really our mind is unmoving and peaceful, just like a leaf which is still as long as no wind blows. If a wind comes up, the leaf flutters. The sense impressions, the fluttering is due to the wind, the sense impressions, and the mind follows them. If it doesn't follow after them, it doesn't flutter. If we know the nature of the impressions of sight and sound and taste and smell, we become peaceful. Our practice is to discover this original peace or original mind, to train our mind to know the impressions that arise and not get lost in them or their stories, to allow it to be peaceful. Just this is the aim of all the difficult practice we put ourselves through. Now, it's important to understand that equanimity is not indifference. Indifference is the near enemy to equanimity. It masquerades as equanimity. And they can be confused. Indifference says, I don't care. I'm not going to be touched by this. I won't let anything bother me. And it's basically a withdrawal, a removal, a barricading, or a fear of life. It doesn't matter. If this doesn't work out, I'll do something else. This marriage doesn't work, I'll get married again. These kids, too much trouble, I could have some more, right? Change job. It's true. You hear it these days. And that's not equanimity. It doesn't matter what happens. I don't care. I can take care of myself. That's a withdrawal, and it's really based on fear. True equanimity is the ability to open our eyes and our heart and enter life fully, to discover the capacity of the heart to open in the midst of all that presents itself to us, to rest in what T.S. Eliot called the still point of the turning world. At the still point of the turning world, neither from nor toward, at the still point, for many of us, we come to spiritual practice, meditation, other kinds of practices, and it's connected with a deep and natural human longing, our heart's wish for wholeness, for love, for connectedness, to learn to trust, some deep wanting that we have, which is part of our whole society as well. I mean, even the young kids on the street, the saying, it's better to be wanted by the police than not wanted at all. You know? It's so deep in us, this wanting for connection. And as we stop and pay attention and practice, as the heart opens and the compassion of our own Buddha nature opens, we can weep tears for ourselves, for the confusion of others, for the sorrow of all beings in the world, so much that we see. And then wonder, well, how can you trust? How can you hold all of this with compassion? Remember the story of the old grandfather who'd never flown in an airplane? And his kids said, our grandchildren, one day, we're going to give you a special treat. And they took him to the local small airport in the summer, got a plane and a pilot, hired them to take their grandfather up in the plane and also to show him around the valley and farm where they had lived. And he didn't really want to go very much. He was frightened of flying. That's why he hadn't flown. But finally, they took him up and he held on. The pilot took him all around the countryside and then the plane landed. They went up to him afterward, and they said, well, Grandpa, how did you like it? Could you see the farm and the valley? He said, I could see everything. Well, were you scared? He said, no, it wasn't so scary after we took off. He said, I got kind of used to it, but I still wasn't so sure about that plane flying. He said, to tell you the truth, I never did let my weight down fully. And in a way, we often live our lives like that, without trusting and without realizing that there is no place but here. There's no place but this present moment. And you can let your weight down. You can trust it completely, because whatever it is that your heart longs for, what it most deeply seeks is here. It can't be anywhere else. It is what we are. We sense that there's some sort of spirit that loves birds and animals and the ants, says Kabir. Perhaps that same spirit who gave a radiance to you in your mother's womb. Is it logical you would be walking around entirely orphaned now? The truth is you turned away yourself and decided to go into the dark. And now you're tangled up and have forgotten what you once knew. Kabir says, why not remember? Today is a good day to do it. You know, there's some mystery that's true about birth and death. this body that we've been given, this mind, that's as mysterious as the fact that it's getting darker and darker, and in a few days, that point of light and the circle of Stonehenge or the great Anasazi ruins and all the medicine circles, that place of the winter solstice where the sun goes just that far and then starts back the other way. That's us too. A few days ago, the son of a dear friend of mine, a young boy who I had taught in retreats, died suddenly and unexpectedly and kind of tragically. I was talking with them and then with the parent in a series of conversations of another child who had died this last year. And their child died in an accident. And they kept thinking, I wish it could have been different. I wish I said they couldn't go on this trip where they died. And I wish all the kinds of regrets. And this mother was telling me not long after she came back from going to get the body and do the burial, all this terrible stuff. She was sitting home a few days later and grieving and feeling absolutely desolate. And her son came to her. She said, as clearly as you could imagine. And first he just was there, kind of in his presence, to somehow reassure her. And then in his own way, he had a pretty good sense of humor. He looked her right in the eye and he said, it's okay, I'm just dead, Mom. Don't worry about it. When we were in India and my wife's brother died, I tell this story, she knew a week before we got the telegram just when he died and how he died. She saw the whole vision of it, and it was true. So there's something going on that's bigger than what it appears on the surface. I'll tell you one more of these kind of stories. Stan Groff, who I teach with and who's a dear friend, one of his colleagues, a physician that he worked with for many years, also died in a diving accident in the Atlantic, in a kind of tragic way, leaving his family. And there was a great deal of grief about this. And then one day, some weeks after he had died, he came to see his wife in this other form, whatever you want to call it. And he talked to her about how he had died and that he loved her and missed her and wanted her now to go on and live her life. And very beautiful kind of healing took place. And then she said, well, how do I know I'm not just making all this up? How do I know this isn't just the wish of my, mind in pain and grief? And he said, all right. He said, go up to the attic. There's a box there of my things in this corner of the attic that has books in it. And if you look at the bottom of the box, there'll be a book that I'm really sorry about because I borrowed it from a friend years ago and promised I would return it, and I never have. If you open the inside of the book, you'll see his name. He gave the name Roy, whatever it was, and the address will be there, and I want you to send it back to him. So then the husband disappeared. She sat for a while kind of stunned. And then it was hard to do. She made herself walk up the steps, upstairs, and then go into the attic and look. And sure enough, there was a box in the attic. She didn't know this box, had never seen it. This book's and opened and got to the bottom, and there was the book with the title as he had said. And she opened it, and there was the man's name. When we went back to Florida, after being in India, visiting my wife's parents after her brother had died, it was actually a few years later, Liana, my wife, told her parents the story of knowing how Paul, her brother, had died that day in the mountains in India, even though we didn't hear for a week. And how the day after his death, my wife had seen him in a vision as a healer, as one of her spirit guides, got blessings from him. And her mother said, well, actually, I never told anybody. They're very plain folks and go to church in the Methodist church every week and watch TV and, you know, live in a retirement park and don't talk about anything weird, she said. But she said, I was sitting here watching TV. It was just not many days after Paul died. And he came here and he sat in that chair over there. And he came every night for an hour or two for 3 months. And he would just sit there quietly and look at us, look at me and your dad, as if he was trying to understand something. And I look back at him. We just feel the things we felt. And gradually, after a few months, it felt like whatever he needed to do or learn, he finished. And he slowly faded away, and he never came back. What do you think? I mean, where do you come from? How did you get in here? You know, there's something a lot bigger going on than just Christmas shopping, folks. Equanimity comes when we rest in the crown chakra, in this place that sees the mystery and the dance of life, this unfathomable mystery, and enters into it with peace and joy. This is from Wendell Berry. He says, my friends, every day do something that won't compute. Love the Lord. Love the world. Work for nothing. Take what you have and give it to the poor. Love someone who does not deserve it. Ask questions that have no answers. Invest in the millennium. Plant sequoias. Say that your main crop is the forest. You know, put your faith in the 2 inches of soil that will build under the redwoods and sequoias every 1,000 years. To see with the heart or the eyes of a Buddha is to rest in a place of grace and trust of the seasons and fearlessness in the midst of all things that we don't know. It's called beginner's mind, don't know mind. And all that we can do is give our heart each day to this precious moment, to this day, to what's there for us. That kind of fearlessness, the image for me is the man, remember, who used to go out in the square in Sarajevo and play his cello every afternoon, the old man. And it didn't matter that there were snipers and bombs. He just did it. Because the world needed music, maybe more than anything. And that music is a kind of harmony that we find in our lives when we rest in this mystery. And it's much bigger than all our plans. We don't know. To awaken is to bow and honor to all the difficulties and beauties and all the stuff of the world together. Bertolt Brecht. Recently, my fingers have developed a prejudice against comparatives. They all follow this pattern. A squirrel is smaller than a tree. A bird is more musical than a tree. The moon is cooler than the wind. Each of us is the strongest one in his own skin. Characteristics should take off their hats to one another instead of judging one another's faces. What can you do? All your plans, the way it's supposed to be. It is the way it is. And you can love it, and you can feed the poor, and clothe those who need it, and work for justice. And in the end, what matters is the heart you bring to it. You can be free, and that freedom touches every being. When you discover this, wherever you set your feet, is sacred. This is the Buddha's pure land. It's nowhere else if not here. My teacher, somebody asked him if he was enlightened. He said, I don't know. He said, I'm like a tree, and there are birds that nest and winds that come and the leaves grow and flowers come and go and people take shade under it, it seems like. He said, I'm just a tree. That's all. I don't know if I'm enlightened. How could somebody know? So there's a practice of equanimity. Although we can cultivate boundless compassion and strive to alleviate suffering, still the nature of the world is praise and blame and joy and sorrow and birth and death and so many things we cannot affect. Like St. Francis's prayer, the Lord grant me the courage to change the things I can, the patience to accept the things I cannot, and the wisdom to know the difference, the serenity prayer. And the equanimity meditations come with a recitation of phrases. May I be balanced and at peace. May I have a peaceful heart. May I be undisturbed at all the events of the world. May I rest like the great ocean or the sky with waves and clouds. All created things arise and pass, joy and sorrow, pleasant and unpleasant events, people, animals, buildings, nations, civilizations. All beings dance through this life, following their own patterns, karma. They live, arise and pass according to deeds and conditions. May I rest in a great heart of peace and kindness. May I see with the eyes and heart of a Buddha. Breath and thoughts, the birth and death of all there is, and the space that contains them all, rest in that space, open and kind, touching all things. And allowing for the seasons that are true.
This concludes The Roots of Buddhist Psychology with Jack Kornfield. Music by Nawang Kechog from the album Sounds of Peace, available through the Sounds True catalog. For more information on classes and retreats with Jack Kornfield, please contact Spirit Rock Meditation Center, 415-488-0164, or write to Spirit Rock Center, P.O. Box 909, Woodacre, California, 94973. If you are interested in additional audio recordings by Jack Kornfield or by other Vipassana meditation instructors, please contact the Dharma Seed Tape Library, 508-544-2653, or write the Dharma Seed Tape Library, 482 Orange Road, Northfield, Massachusetts, 01360. And if you would like additional copies of this audio learning set, or for a complete free catalog of transformational audio tapes, please contact Sounds True, 800-333-9185, or write the Sounds True catalog, 735 Walnut Street, Boulder, Colorado, 80302. Thank you for listening.